KUOW is a self-sustaining service of the University of Washington.
From KUOW Seattle, this is Weekday. I'm Marcy Silman. The United States isn't the only North American government collecting metadata information. Canada's defense ministry is surveying citizens' data, too, and not everybody there is pleased. Vaughn Palmer will have more on that story just after 10 o'clock. Also coming up today, a couple of mystery book recommendations from Nancy Pearl. A new study from the University of Washington's Institute on Alcohol and Drug Abuse shows that prescription drug abuse is down. Heroin use is on the rise, though, and joining us to talk more about this is Caleb Banta Green. He's a research scientist at the Alcohol and Drug Abuse Institute, also affiliate assistant professor of health services at the UW School of Public Health. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much.
How do you study heroin use? I don't imagine that people volunteer that information.
Two very different ways. One is you talk to heroin users, and the other is you look at all sorts of what I would call indicator data. They don't directly measure what's going on, but to give a sense in terms of the other impacts. And so it's very important to look at both sides of the data, what exactly are heroin users experiencing, and then also looking at some sort of secondary data. What I don't look at are phone survey data, which are just notoriously a dramatic underreport because you're missing the most dramatically and negatively impacted people.
So let's start first with the prescription drug abuse numbers. Those fell. What is that due to?
The prescription drug abuse numbers, it's hard to know exactly what it's due to, although the associations are pretty strong. Washington State took a lot of actions in the mid-2000s, late-2000s, looking at trying to sort of tamp down on overprescribing of opiates. And just so people are clear, opiate pain medicines are things like Vicodin, OxyContin, methadone, morphine, and so on. And what we actually saw was that in 2008, prescribing of the strongest opiates actually leveled off in Washington State. That's actually ahead of most of the United States. Some of those numbers kept going up. And we quite quickly saw a decline in prescription opiate-involved overdose deaths and some other indicators as well. So we think that reining in prescribing is part of the issue. But the other thing also is one of the most commonly abused medications was OxyContin, which is an extended-release form of oxycodone. And at the time, for quite a while throughout the 2000s, it could be crushed and snorted, and a huge dose could be administered. The manufacturer changed how that was made, and in October 2010, that they put in sort of a gel-like substance, and that became much harder to abuse, and we quite quickly saw a decline in oxycodone. So those two things together look like they've contributed to this.
So you saw the decline in this wide array of prescription opiate abuse. Exactly at that same time, the heroin use numbers went up?
Yeah, what we actually saw was a little bit of, the prescription opiate numbers have gone up for more than 15 years until they really started declining in 2009. And heroin numbers started to uptick around 2005, but interestingly, they really increased dramatically around 2009, right as prescription opiate availability went down in the diverted market. So it wasn't that we just had prescription opiates, they went away and heroin replaced it. Heroin was already starting to increase, but we've really seen a dramatic change in the last 3 years, and that's actually what really stands out to me. I last did a report with numbers through 2009 that said, wow, we're really increasing prescription opiates, and heroin's also increasing. But in the last 3 years, the prescription opiates have declined, and the heroin indicators are increasing. And I think what's really important I want to make clear is that we really think this is about people who are abusing prescription opiates or switching over to heroin because of availability and cost.
A particular type of heroin?
The heroin we have on the West Coast is Mexican black tar heroin. It's very low purity, and what really matters about that is that you pretty much need to inject it to get an effective high, and that's very important because of some of the health consequences related to injection drug use. Certainly, HIV numbers are actually very, very low among injection drug users in Washington State, in part because we started syringe exchange in Tacoma. Dave Purchase did in 1988, so our HIV numbers have been quite suppressed. But hepatitis is more easily transmitted through drug-related behaviors. And our hepatitis C numbers, 75% of injection drug users in King County have hepatitis C. And we're sort of facing unknown issues around syringe exchange availability across the state. There's some thought about potentially reining in and defunding some of the syringe exchanges. And my word of advice is we need to be hyper-vigilant because just as we're seeing an increase in young heroin injectors across the state, we're trying to think about, gee, should we continue to be funding syringe exchanges? And those syringe exchanges are a terrific place, obviously, to provide good information and supplies that people need to prevent infectious disease, but it's a wonderful platform to also do overdose prevention work.
We're talking with Caleb Banta Green from the University of Washington. You mentioned King County numbers, but you studied numbers statewide, correct?
That's right.
And are you seeing the same kind of increase in heroin use outside of the King County sort of Puget Sound corridor?
Absolutely. The increase in Washington State over the last decade is among 18 to 29-year-olds outside of the Seattle metropolitan area. That is where the increase is. We still have a tremendous problem in the Seattle area, no doubt, but a dramatic rise across the Washington State.
And particularly in that age group.
Yeah, it's really getting driven by this 18 to 29-year-old age group. And that's not, the 18 to 29-year-old age group is a pretty good proxy for people who might have been abusing prescription opiates, because people who are prescribed opiates generally, in terms of long-term prescribing, are older and have chronic pain conditions.
Mm-hmm.
So that younger group is more likely to be a group using prescription opiates in an abusive manner. And, you know, one of the good signs that we saw in the data is that for the first time in 2012, we saw a decline in 10th graders reporting using prescription opiates to get high in the last month. So that's a really positive thing. We're preventing a new group of people from coming on and becoming addicted to opiates and potentially switching to heroin. Unfortunately, opiate addiction is a very, very, a very strong hold on people and really is often a lifelong struggle. So we have a lot of people in the state now who we're going to need to be getting good services to so that they can return to sort of good functionality. The most conservative estimate I have in terms of new heroin users, and this is just based on people who've come into treatment for the first time in Washington State and their primary drug is heroin, more than 8,000 people across Washington in the last decade.
You mentioned a bit earlier the wide evidence of hepatitis infection among intravenous drug users, and you talked about syringe exchanges. Some people know those as needle exchanges. What about addiction services statewide? Do those exist?
Yeah, so wonderful question. So we think about primary prevention, don't start using in the first place. Secondary prevention, getting services to people who are having problems such as addiction treatment, and then tertiary prevention, which is overdose prevention. So let me talk about treatment a little bit. We have a really nice new type of medication-assisted treatment, and that is called buprenorphine, or our brand name is Suboxone. And so we also have methadone, which is a long-standing type of treatment modality people may be familiar with. The nice thing about buprenorphine or Suboxone is it can be prescribed by a physician out of their office. And the University of Washington Family Medicine Department, Dr. Roger Rosenblatt and his group, has worked very hard to increase capacity in rural areas for rural providers to be Suboxone providers. And they're finding quite transformative, the drug to be quite transformative in their practice, because instead of having patients who are coming in medication seeking and really struggling with addiction, they're now able to engage them in drug treatment, which is really being done out of a doctor's office. And so that's a really nice opportunity for people to be engaged in treatment. And medication-assisted treatment means a person who's addicted to opiates, and they take opiates every day, whether it's in an addictive way, with pain medicines that are being abused, or heroin, instead they take this medication, methadone or buprenorphine, that is just used to prevent withdrawal, to keep them from going into withdrawal and feeling sick, and then they can return to normal functioning. And we know that definitely improves health outcomes, keeps people alive, and improves economic outcomes as well.
Is it as expensive as methadone treatment?
Methadone treatment is quite inexpensive. Suboxone is more expensive. Right now we have a fairly minimal amount of public funding. We're hoping under the Affordable Care Act, starting in January 2014, there will be better funding for that treatment.
I'm looking at numbers when we talk about heroin use up and down, and as you mentioned, this is something that you've been tracking for a long time. If you step back from this particular study, is there anything that you can see about long range, what kinds of drug use we really should be worried about in the future? Is it addictive opiates or with the legalization of marijuana, is there something else of concern?
So what I think is really important is that we engage in a dialogue with parents and kids and medical providers and others about why we take any foreign substance, why we take alcohol, why we take prescription drugs, why we take illegal drugs, why we take marijuana. What are the reasons for that? And that parents are transparent and honest with themselves about why they do it, talk with their kids about why they use them. And so I think the point is, in some ways, we take psychoactive substances for a lot of different reasons, and we don't talk about it. And there may be healthful reasons that people take it. People may be taking it for a medical reason, but they generally don't talk to their kids about it. You know, we say prescription opiates have gone up 300% in the last decade in terms of prescribing. Antidepressants have gone up 150%. And I'm not saying it's good or bad, but I'm saying we need to have honest, transparent conversations on a regular basis about why we take things such as alcohol or medications or other substances.
Caleb Banta-Green is a research scientist at the Alcohol and Drug Abuse Institute at the University of Washington, where he's also affiliate assistant professor of health services at the UW School of Public Health. Caleb Banta-Green, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
This is Weekday. I'm Marcy Silman.
It was 9:18 on a Wednesday morning. I turned on the radio. I heard a woman's voice. She said her name was Nancy. Nancy Pearl. A made-up name, I assumed, but so what? More importantly, she said she had some information for me. About books. Books that I might want to read. Okay, I said, I'll bite. Go ahead, tell me about these books. I will, she said, in a minute. Fair enough, I thought. We'll play it your way, Nancy Pearl.
Support for KUOW comes from Hagen Northwest Fresh, celebrating 80 years of supporting Washington's farmers, ranchers, and fishermen. Online at hagen.com.
No mystery today surrounding the weather outlook. It's going to be clouds and showers today with a high of 66. Currently partly cloudy and 55. I'm Bernard Ouellette. It's 9:19.
From 94.9 KUOW, I'm Marcy Silman. School's almost out, and maybe you're contemplating a vacation, and if you are, or even if you're not, summer's sometimes the perfect time to do a little recreational reading. And here, with a couple of suggestions, a little mini-visit from our favorite librarian, Nancy Pearl. And Nancy, you have brought in recommendations in my particular favorite bonbon genre. That's what I call mysteries, the bonbon of books.
And I have brought in, this has not been a good spring for me reading-wise because it's been very hard for me to find anything that I've just absolutely loved. But here are two books that meet that.
Oh, that's good. I'm excited.
The first one is called The Last Policeman by Ben H. Winters. The sequel is already out and written and coming out. This The Last Policeman has just been available in paperback. So there it is for all those plane trips. I just have to say, I read the sequel first and just loved it and then went back and read The Last Policeman, which I had somehow missed.
American, British, where is it?
It's American. It's set in a small town in Concord. Well, it's set in a small New Hampshire town, mainly in Concord, New Hampshire. And the shtick of this series, which cannot take too long, is that in exactly 6 months, the scientists know to the day when this is going to happen, an asteroid is going to hit the Earth, and life as we know it will come to an end. Nobody quite knows what will happen. Nobody quite knows whether anybody will survive.
So this is not science fiction?
No, this is not science fiction. That is the background. The question is, how do you behave? What do you do when you know that the world as you know it is coming to an end? And especially how this affects this young policeman who is really doing the job of his dreams. This is what he has all his life wanted to be, a cop, and he wanted to be a detective. And he is given this case, which is, everybody says, an obvious suicide. But he believes, and he's not sure why he believes this, but he believes it was murder. And he sets out to find out what was behind that death of that stranger.
Did Ben Winters set this task for himself so he would know that he doesn't have to do, for example, A through Z mysteries?
Wouldn't that be good?
I don't know. I've never heard of this writer.
No, neither had I. And then it turned out he's written some children's books as well, which I have put on hold at the library and hope to get very soon. But if going by these two mysteries, this first one, The Last Policeman, and the second one, which is called Countdown City, he's just fabulous. Wonderful at building characters. Even minor characters are totally real.
Okay, that's Ben H. Winters, and the book, it's good to start with the first one, right?
Yes, definitely.
The Last Policeman. A second title, Crashed?
Crashed by Timothy Hallinan. Timothy Hallinan has long been one of my favorite mystery writers. He's written a terrific series set in Bangkok where the main character is a guy named Poke Rafferty.
I've read these books.
Aren't they great?
Yes, they are.
Yes. And those again, you should probably start with the first one, which someone can help you find. A librarian or bookseller can help you find the first one. But in fact, you could read them in any order because they're just pleasurable to read. Now, Poke Rafferty Timothy Hallinan has begun a whole new series. And this series is set in Los Angeles. And the main character is a charming, very charming, a wonderful father, thief, and a rogue. And he becomes the kind of criminal's fixer. So whenever a criminal has some difficulty, he calls on Junior Bender to fix.
Great name.
Yes, to fix the problem. And in this first book, Crashed, a mob guy is making a pornographic film and things are going totally wrong on set all the time. And Junior is called in to figure out what's happening. This is one of those books that I felt when I finished this first book, I couldn't wait to read the second book. And when I finished the second book, I could not wait to read the third book. And I can't wait till he writes some more about Junior Bender. Crashed is just an absolute delight.
Well, Timothy Hallinan's Poke Rafferty is kind of another one of those not quite wholesome protagonists.
No, and especially because the Poke Rafferty books, which are set in Thailand, have that whole sort of seedy sense and the kind of sexual depravity, and Poke fights against that. I mean, that's his mission, is to save the street children.
Yeah, but he lives with a former bar girl.
He marries her.
He marries her former. I haven't read that book yet.
And
just ruined it all.
And adopts a little girl off the streets named Meow.
Let me just, as you're talking about Crashed and the sort of good guy, bad guy persona, I flashed back to a writer named Lawrence Block.
Oh, yes.
Who created a whole series of Bernie the Burglar.
Oh, I was thinking of his other series with Matt Scudder.
Which are also really great.
Yes.
But these are these characters that are seriously flawed.
Yes.
And I wonder about the appeal of that. Obviously, Ben Winter's Last Policeman, this is like a good guy.
Yeah.
I'm thinking,
yes,
you know, clean and nose clean, all,
you know, quarterback on the high school football team.
But in some ways, while those are really fun, we find ourselves very attracted to these sort of good, bad guys, bad, good guys.
Yeah.
Good, bad guys.
Right. Good and bad guys.
Yeah.
Maybe it's now I would those the Bernie Rodenbaugh books, which are the burglar ones, have never been my favorites of his books. It's always been the Matt Scudder books.
That's Lawrence Block.
Lawrence Block's. Isn't that who?
Yeah.
Yeah. Lawrence Block's Matt Scudder books, which are much darker. But Matt himself is still struggling with the kind of person he wants to be, and how he wants to live out the rest of his life. So I mean, I think maybe in some ways it's a growth. You know, that we're finally seeing in books as in real life that people are not one dimensional, that they have these positive sides and these negative sides, and that goes for everybody, whether it's us or our best friends.
Well, let me just ask another question about mysteries in general. This idea of development really affects this genre. This is what was called genre fiction.
Yes.
And I'm not sure if we still call it genre fiction. And yet within that genre, there are books that are still the sort of I guess you can't buy a dime store novel anymore, but what you think of as dime store mysteries, when the genre took off and was making gazillions of dollars for publishers, everybody jumped on the bandwagon. But within that, you have maybe writers like Ben Winters or Timothy Hallinan who are taking things one step further.
And I think that that's the problem with this whole notion of what is genre literature, because I think that we judge genres by the worst of what's there. So we judge mysteries by those that have very hackneyed plots, i.e. the butler did it.
Mm-hmm.
We judge all the genres by the worst of what's available, what's out there. When they get to be too good, then we use that sort of slippery phrase, oh, they transcended the genre, which is one of my least favorite sentences in the English language.
Because a good mystery is still a good mystery, whether or not, I mean, there are certain criteria that you know, because you know my reading habits from so many years, certain things that I like to have in the book. But above that, if it has no plot, then it's something else. It's a piece of fiction, which is fine, but it's not a mystery.
And the problem is that we still act as though, we still behave as though, we still, in some part of our hearts, believe, many of us, that mysteries are somehow, mysteries, romances, westerns, mm-hmm. science fiction and fantasy, are somehow inferior to a literary novel. And how we're defining a literary novel, everything is so slippery. Where do you put Jodi Picoult? Where do you put... where do you put Anne Tyler? Where do you put Michael Chabon? You know, we think, well, I guess I know where I would put them. I think I could make a list and that would satisfy me. But that's not going to satisfy you. It's just my reading of it and what I'm looking for. So these two mysteries, and I'm, as you know, also always looking for outstanding mysteries, and to find books that have this traditional mystery plot, what happens, who did it, and yet along with that have this very just wonderful writing and great, great characters. The Ben Winters was, because I had never heard of him before, I think was the most pleasant surprise of the spring.
So Ben Winters, The Last Policeman, Timothy Hallinan's Crashed, both begin... series, although Ben Winter's series might not last very long because people only have 6 months. That's not a secret, right?
There's only six months
on Earth.
Yes.
Well, thank you for a little fix. This is our little book fix. Nancy will be back in a couple of weeks. Nancy Pearl is the author of the Book Lust series, host of Seattle Channel show Book Lust with Nancy Pearl. And she's here this summer every couple of weeks on weekday. See you soon.
Thanks, Marcy.
There are more mysteries to come. The mystery of what to do with those random leftovers in your fridge. The Chef in the Hat, Terry Rotaro, helps you crack the case in a minute.
Support for KUOW comes from Washington's Lottery, supporting the Washington Opportunity Pathways account to help fund higher education scholarships in Washington. More at walottery.com.
Next time on The World, a mystery on a London street. After the body of a man dropped from the sky.
He had no identity papers on him, no passport, indicating who he might have been. They only knew that he came from Angola because a flight from Luanda was passing overhead.
Who he was and how he wound up in the wheel well of a plane bound for London, next time on The World.
Later today on KUOW's Afternoon News Magazine, which airs from 3 to 8 p.m.
Support for KUOW comes from the Seattle Symphony, presenting Benjamin Britten's War Requiem on June 13th and 15th, conducted by Ludovic Morlot and featuring two orchestras, three vocal soloists, and three choirs. Tickets and information by calling the box office or online at seattlesymphony.org.
56 degrees, partly cloudy in Seattle, expecting clouds through the day with a good chance of showers and a high of 66. I'm Bernard Ouellette. It's 9:31. A new study on distracted driving concludes that using voice commands to text while driving is even more dangerous than talking on the phone. What we're learning about distracted driving in 30 minutes.
All right. This song goes out to all the leftovers. What's in the fridge?
What's in the fridge?
You know what that music means. This is Weekday. I'm Marcy Silman. Other day, I was looking through the vegetable drawer in my refrigerator, and I was searching for vegetables that I could stir fry. I found they weren't quite funky carrots, but they were funk, like that song.
It's a perfect time to fry them.
Yeah, and some half-wilted chard, but the chard's still in there. And if you, Terry Rotaro, had been here before my search, I'm sure you would have had a fabulous suggestion.
I would have probably sauteed both of those in olive oil, toasted almonds thrown into there, maybe a little crumbled goat cheese, and
I'm good to go.
With that, with your pasta. Be done.
Well, you know, Terry, he's the chef in the hat, author of Rover's Recipes from the Chef in the Hat. Rover's is counting down.
10 days to go.
10 days of Rover's, so get in there while you can. But Luke, which is its next door neighbor,
right,
will
it's
still
staying there. Oh, yeah.
Okay. Well, that's good.
Our French American neighborhood bistro is staying. And we are working on a new restaurant, so.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Oh.
Opening in the fall. Stay tuned. We'll let you know. Where
Same space?
No.
Okay.
Different part of town.
Okay. It's like the big mystery.
That's right.
What is in your fridge? Do you have a question about combination? 206-543-5869, 1-800-289-5869, or Weekday at KUOW.org. Now, here we don't have anything yet, but I had this conversation with my mother, who's in town, because my son is graduating high school, which
mine did last night.
Yeah, so this is the season. And I said, oh, you know, I've subscribed to a CSA box. I started last summer, and the box comes, and there's things in the box that, you know, what's this brown root thing?
Well, after 3 weeks of child, you're like, can we eat something else?
Yeah, so there it is. And my mother said, well, what if you don't like those things? I said, well, it doesn't matter. You have to you cook them.
That's right.
So it's forced my hand in a bit. I get to consult cookbooks, or I get to, you know, like, here's Jerusalem artichoke.
Oh, those are so delicious.
Now, so what do you do with a Jerusalem artichoke?
You peel them, and then after that, you can use it just like a root vegetable of any kind, but usually you peel them, or you can roast them whole and then peel them afterward.
Mm-hmm. Do you have to wrap it up to roast
No,
it?
No. Just toss in a little bit of olive oil and then put them in the oven and roast them whole.
Yum.
Or you can make, it makes wonderful soup. You know, I think it makes a
Jerusalem artichoke.
Yeah. It makes a great soup. So if you take the whole thing, peel them off, you know, with a pad, you just take a green pad and peel them off. And then you put them in a pot of water,
yum.
A little bit of salt, a little bit of lemon juice, just a little bit. And then bring it to a boil until it's totally tender. Get rid of the half of the liquid. Put a little bit of cream, just a little bit, not to go crazy. And then blend the whole thing up in your wonderful Vitamix blender, the one that will never break. And everything becomes pureed, and it's a delicious. I love the bite, and it has a tiny bite in the back, and I think it makes a wonderful artichoke. Now, my parents, growing after World War II, or during World War II, I should say, in the fields, that's what they had the most, because it's an easy root to grow, and it's almost like a weed. You know, it grows very easily. So
Jerusalem artichoke.
Yeah, and by the end of it's called topinambour in France, and by the end of. By the end of the war, late 40s, my parents were like, we never want to eat another one of those.
Right. It's too disgusting for.
Well, you know, when you eat it every day, eventually it becomes like you're tired of that.
So, yeah, this is the issue with these CSA boxes, or if you have a garden in your backyard and it's not quite time to go hog wild nuts because you have a lot growing. It's not been that warm. But you do get these boxes and you're like, whoa. Two endive heads. You know, I did learn how to braise endive last
summer.
You
can grill endive, too. It does a great grilling job.
Now, how do you keep it from all the leaves falling through the slats in the grill?
Yeah, well, you have to leave it whole, and you have to put a little bit of olive oil, salt, pepper, very simply down. You could even put a little bit of just a little bit of cayenne pepper or some kind of a hot spice right around your oil, so you can brush that over the endive, and one of the best way to do it is to cut the endive in half.
Okay,
so now you have a butterfly. Yeah, you have a butterfly endive, and you put that on the grill part, so it will cook from the inside, from the outside in.
Oh,
so everything will cook faster.
So I put the
inside, flat side on the grill.
Oh, okay.
And then once that's nice and charred, you just put it on the other side and, you know, finish the outside. But it will help go faster to cook and make it a much better vegetable to eat. And it's also a great vegetable to grill and then to slice and put into a salad. For example, you could do roast grilled eggplant, endive, tomatoes, cheese, whatever cheese you want to use in there.
Yum, yum, yum.
It could
yum.
Be mozzarella, lots of basil and all that stuff. And you end up with a wonderful summer, almost like an antipasto kind of idea.
Sounds very Mediterranean.
Very Mediterranean.
I can smell it now. 1-800-289-5869 is our number. Michael is in Fife. Hi, Michael.
Hi, Michael.
Howdy. Hey, guys.
What's in your fridge?
Well, I could really use some help today because I'm homesick, so...
Okay, so chicken soup. Chicken soup is where we're going, right there.
Okay, sounds good. That's good. I have one chicken thigh, so that's all I have for a meat. I've got some kale, some green spinach. I've got some broccoli, one English cucumber, and some sharp cheddar. And I've got two hard-boiled eggs, and that's...
I love the...
There's a tiny bit of red onion left.
Oh, you got everything to make a wonderful soup there. Do you have any chicken stock in your cupboard?
I've got a little bit of broth. That's all I got, but I guess that would have to work, huh?
Yeah, that's perfect. That's perfect. So what I would do is I would take those kale leaf. You know what's very popular right now is kale chips. Mm-hmm. So we're going to create the garnish before we do anything. Since you've got a little bit of time on your hand and you're starting to cook now for lunch or for dinner, you can put those kale leaves in the oven on the sheet pan. Mm-hmm. Just put them as is. You know, wash them off, dry them off, shake them good. Drizzle nothing on it. Don't just put the kale chips right like that in the oven, or the kale leaf, I should say. And they will dry out and become like kale chips, which when you take them out, you can either make a dip for it, which I wouldn't recommend because you sound like you're sick. So I would say... keep it as clean as possible. Stay away from dairy. You know, get better and make something really healthy for yourself.
Okay.
The chicken thigh, you can choose to either bone it out or keep it on the bone and roast it by itself, throw it in the oven. You're going to have the kale. You can do the chicken first, then finish the kale later on. Or the kale requires a very, very low heat. So I'm not so sure those two can marry, actually. Mm. I would maybe even take the chicken and put it into the broth that you already have. Add a little bit of water. Put a little bit of carrot and onion if you have that in your cupboard, or just some spices like thyme and bay leaf. Mm-hmm. And put your leg in there and poach it as opposed to roast it. Does that make sense?
Yep.
So poach your leg in there. When it's ready, you take it out. And then what I would do is I would do the spinach sauteed on the side with a little bit of olive oil.
Okay.
Just sauteed in the pan. Keep that on the side. Put your broccoli florets into your soup. Put the chicken back into your soup, and then at the last minute, take your hard-boiled egg, cut them in quarters, and then throw them into your soup as well. I love a hard-boiled egg in my soup.
Wow.
Nice.
You could either grate it, or you can just put quarters of hard-boiled egg in there. So it's going to warm up instantly. Your red onion, you know what I would do? I would pickle them, because you're going to have a beautiful soup of chicken that's going to have a very standard flavor, and then you put those red onion pickled on top of that, it's going to really brighten the whole thing up. Make a couple crusty. You know how to pickle an onion?
No,
right?
Tell me.
Okay, so you make a broth of like, the measurement is 3, 2, and 1. So 3 water, 2 sugar, 1 vinegar. Yeah? You get that?
Mm-hmm.
All right. Bring that to a boil. You can add spices like coriander, juniper berry, bay leaf, thyme. You could put all kinds of different spices in there that you want to add to that. Bring it to a boil. Let it steep for about 10 minutes. Strain the whole thing up, and now you get a broth, a brine, basically. You take that when it's still warm, not boiling hot, but still warm, and then pour that right over your sliced red onion for mm-hmm. about 5 minutes. And now you've got pickled red onion, because the flavor instantly goes into the onion.
Wow.
Keep that brine for further use and use it under different things. You could actually, once that brine is very cold, you could take that and put your cucumbers and you have, slice them super thin, put the brine on top of it, and tonight you can have a little something with some brine cucumber.
That's 3 parts water, 2 parts sugar, 1 part vinegar, right?
That's right.
All right.
All right.
You know what? When I give you a portion like this, bring it to a boil, put your finger in there, taste it. If you find it too sweet, you add more vinegar. If you find it too vinegary, you add a little bit of water.
Sure.
All right?
Thank you, sir.
You are so welcome. And get better.
Yeah, feel better, Michael.
Yeah,
thanks.
It's gonna be fun today.
Yeah. Well, no, it sounds like he's not going to stay.
Now you got a project.
Yeah, he's going to be busy cooking. 1-800-289-5869, 206-543-5869 is our number. I have a here's my perennial question. It has to do with eggs for dinner, because when I don't have anything in my refrigerator, I almost always have half dozen, quarter,
you know, it's
eggs.
It's very French to make an omelette for dinner.
Does anything, my question is, can anything go inside of eggs, or are there?
Of course. What would not go in there?
I don't know.
So the secret of that, for example, you have let's say you have a thigh of chicken left in the fridge that's cooked already.
Right.
You have, let's say some, you have half an onion, you have even tomato, quarter tomato, whatever. Bacon that's cooked from breakfast, that's left over, a couple pieces, right? Take your bacon, dice it down. Take your chicken, break it down. Take your tomato, dice everything. Mm-hmm. You know, basically dice everything. Take a pan, bit of butter. Once it comes to a white foamy stage, just throw in your chicken first. Then you want to make sure that everything gets hot.
Okay.
So it gets to above 135, 140. You want to get that temperature. So it's very easy to do when you dice everything small and you put it in a hot pan. It will warm up very quickly. Mm. So first the chicken. Then what else did we say we have in there? Tomato.
Bacon.
Bacon. So you put all that stuff in there and you really give it a nice warmed up. Then you have your beaten egg. And when you do a beaten egg for an omelet, you do not use a blender or anything. You should use just a fork. So you break down the eggs, but not to a stage of like liquid stage separated.
Mm-hmm.
That make sense?
Yes.
So then you pour that omelet right on top of it and you don't touch it for about 10, 20 seconds. You let it sit a little bit.
Okay.
And then you can just start shaking your pan with a rubber spatula. Or your fork if you don't care about your pan, and go like my mom used to do.
Right.
And then go around and refill, take the sides and bring them back towards the inside. So basically what happens is the egg cooks instantly on the outside.
Right.
So the more you bring it back inside, that movement brings back all the cooked egg in the middle, and the outside keeps cooking. So it's kind of like a movement like this. You can also do it by doing...
So I wish we had a video camera. He's showing me how his pan goes.
You know, when you do the flipping of the things, well, there's a lot of that truth. You know, at the beginning, then you flip like this, your omelets become cooked evenly everywhere.
Yeah.
But a good omelet should be runny on the inside.
That is what I have heard, and I have lots of fights with my family about that when I serve them eggs that way. I say, this is how it's supposed to be, according to everybody.
Well, it's not to everybody. Sometimes, you know, it's too runny. And it is true, but it's always easier to cook eggs again or cook them longer. If your omelet is not quite finished, all you have to do is cover the whole pan. It will keep on cooking, no problem, and it cooks fast.
And it's really easy, and it's protein, and it tastes good.
Right. And another thing you can do with eggs is you can do poached eggs. I mean, poached eggs are delicious, and they go well on top of salads. They go well on top of roasted chicken. They go well on top of pasta. You know, there's nothing nicer than a beautiful poached egg in the middle of a plate with other things around it. You know, it's like delicious. Even with vegetables, just sauteed vegetable, make a wonderful salad and put your poached egg right on top and then break that egg right through your salad, season with a little bit of finishing salt. Mm.
It sounds good. My go-to has been a sort of fried leeks with leftover rice, and then I put the egg on top.
Beautiful.
Crisped garlic and ginger.
I love that.
Yeah, you and Jean-Georges von Gerichten, because it's his recipe. If I use duck fat, it would be his recipe.
Yeah.
I'm going to give the phone number again, but we have some emails. 206-543-KUOW, 543-5869. Toll free 1-800-289-5869. Terry Rotrow is with us for the rest of this hour, helping you to recombine what is in your refrigerator. And Vic writes, last year, he's asking you to recap, you gave a recipe for the most incredible sounding asparagus soup I ever heard of. Can you recap for me and I will take notes this time?
What's his name? I'm sorry?
Vic.
Vic.
Victor.
Vic. Now, Vic, I don't know how old you are, but my memory doesn't serve me so right anymore. I mean, what I said last year about an asparagus soup, I'm going to try. But the way I make an asparagus soup most commonly is I take an onion, slice thin, I put butter in a pot. 99% of the time it starts with butter. Sometimes it starts with olive oil, but most of the time it starts with butter. Because with butter, it's always so much better.
That's Julia Child that you just captured via...
Creme fraiche, they call it in France. I love her. Anyway, so you melt your butter to a white foamy stage, you throw in your onion, and you sweat those onions. Then you take all your asparagus and you have washed and cut in pieces. What you want to do is try to avoid putting the last inch of the asparagus, because that's inedible. I mean, it's really tough in most cases, but you can figure that out. Put all the asparagus, cut them in small pieces, put them into that pot. And the reason you cut things in small pieces when you make a soup or a stock is so it takes less space in height in your pot. And when it's time for you to put liquid in it, when you need to cover it, you don't need as much liquid, so the flavor stays intensified. All right, we're there. So you put your asparagus in there, you sweat them as well as your onion. You put in any spice you want. You could do, I mean, in most cases, you could put fresh thyme, which I always use, bay leaf, you know, you could put chopped arugula, parsley. I mean, not arugula, chopped cilantro, if you like cilantro.
Really?
Yeah, cilantro and asparagus actually works well.
Really?
For me. But,
okay. You know. I have to try it. I have some in the refrigerator.
Coriander. If you're going to do coriander, do toasted coriander. Whenever you put like spices like pepper, corn, or it's always nice to try to spice them. I mean, put them in a saute pan and cook them a little bit so they're toasted. Put all that in there. Okay. So whatever flavor you want to add at this point is where you put it in. Then you put your broth on top of that, which is a chicken broth or a vegetable stock, which I recommend vegetable stock. And then bring that to a boil. And cook it slowly until it simmers down a little bit. You know, you want to reduce that stock so you want to, you know, cook the asparagus, cook the onion. It doesn't take very long. Within 30 minutes, your asparagus and your onions are all totally cooked. Then I would take a hand blender and blend the whole thing up. And I would strain it through something fairly thin because you're going to have all those long strings of asparagus.
Right.
If you have, again, Vitamix blender, I'm not part of the company, but I love that.
I was just
going
to ask you if they paid you.
No, but they do a great job on their blender, and it's the one I know that I like a lot. And those really puree really, really well, so then it's much easier to strain after that. And then once that asparagus soup is done, there's many things you can do. You can either cool it off and have a cold asparagus soup by finishing with a little dollop of creme fraiche on top,
mm-hmm.
or you can use lemon confit, which lemon and asparagus work really well together.
Mm-hmm.
I don't like raw lemon on my asparagus, but I like confit lemon. Like the confit lemon would be lemon slices or lemon julienne. Then you cook very slowly in a little syrup of sugar with a little bit of vinegar in it.
That sounds good.
So you cook that down. So it's kind of like that sweet and sour vinegar, lemony flavor. And you put that right on top of your asparagus. And then I love chervil. I know I've had fight with Tom Douglas about chervil because he thinks it's a useless herb. I love chervil. Tarragon is another one you can use, but very, very sparingly because tarragon is very strong.
Yes.
Bronze fennel is another one you can use that we have in the garden right now, very commonly found right this time of the year. So.
Yum. Well, that doesn't sound that hard.
No. It's not that hard to do. It's a process like anything else. And if you're going to make soup, don't make soup for one. Make soup for 10. So you can put another quart in the fridge or put 2 cups in the freezer. And then in the next couple of weeks, you can eat, you know, take it out, pop it in the microwave, and you get asparagus soup. Now, you can serve that soup hot or you can serve it cold. You know, either way, or you pick and choose.
But you can't freeze it once you've put the creme fraiche in. You have to do that before.
No, you can put the creme fraiche in it.
And freeze it?
Yeah. When you know, that's where the blender comes in. When you take it out of the freezer, you put it back in the blender and re-blend the whole thing up. Now, you have to go very quick because the cream is going to want to butter up.
Right.
You know, it's going to want to break.
Yep. I have one before we go to Bellevue where our caller is. Thyme. I've got it growing in my garden.
Mm-hmm.
I picked these little tiny sprigs, and then I watched on television somebody taking the leaves off the sprigs.
That's right.
For some reason, I couldn't remember. Do you start at the outside edge and go down, or do you start at the other edge?
Well, it depends on what you're going to be doing with it. Mm-hmm. But if you're going to be chopping it for putting in something, you start from the base up.
Okay.
Because
okay.
It's much easier if you start from the top. But you can't start from the top. You have to go like an inch in because
it's
really tender on top. That part can be chopped with your thyme. It's perfectly fine.
Okay. All right.
So you take your thumb and your index and you put them about an inch in from the top into the branch and you hold it, then you pull it backwards.
Okay.
Because when you pull backwards, it comes out really cleanly. When you go up, it doesn't come as cleanly.
I have it growing in my garden. It's hard to even pick these little tiny branches.
Well, that's
branches.
What you give to the people you invite for dinner or
go
your
outside.
Kids or your... You say, here, just give me a hand. Just
go
like this. Just do this for 5 minutes and I'll have enough chop time.
it is very nice to have all these things growing in a garden, and they're so easy.
And there is no excuse for that because it stays all year round. You know, bay leaf, thyme, those are basic herbs that stays all year round.
We go now to, I got the right button here. Hi, Anthony in Bellevue. You're on the air.
Hi. I got some cold pasta, and I've got olive oil and some onions and eggs. And I'd like to just run a dish by you. What I used to do is... I heat up the pasta, saute the onions and the olive oil, and mix that in, and then just put a cold egg on top of it and mix it up and have an original egg noodle. But I've been watching these cooking channels, and they talk about salmonella and using some special type of eggs.
That's only if you have an Italian connection. I was just trying to make a joke. Salmonella is, you know, it's only if you have a Italian connection then you will get that. No, I'm just trying to make a joke.
I'm Italian.
You're Italian.
Here we go.
Okay, so you put the you crack the eggs onto this cooked onions and pasta. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, so I heat up the pasta, put the onions on it, maybe some garlic, and then I put a cold egg on it and I toss it, and that's how I have it usually. But I stop that after listening to the cooking channels.
Well, where do you get your eggs from?
The regular supermarket.
Yeah, so I wouldn't worry too much about the salmonella part. But in all justice done to listeners, all the listeners out there, you should cook your eggs normally. That's what they require. The cases salmonella can exist even if you cook your eggs some. So in your case, you're not trying to have a complete dry cardboardy scrambled egg on top of your pasta. You're trying to have something runny, right? So my suggestion to you.
Semi-cooked by the hot pasta.
Right. Or the other suggestion is poach your egg and then put it right on top of your pasta so you can take it out of the water when it's still tender and runny and all that stuff. And you can but the way you were describing your pasta, I would cook the onions first and cook the onions until they're totally caramelized. So now you have a different layer of flavor added to your pasta. So you put it in a pan with some butter quite a bit of salt on top of your onion, and you cook them slowly, medium heat, until they're totally caramelized and they go through a translucent stage and then they become caramelized. And that is a beautiful flavor to add to your pasta. Then you can put your pasta in that and toss it around until it's totally warmed up, and then put your poached egg right on top of that. And I would even suggest throwing a couple of leaves of arugula on there that will bring a bite right through your richness of your pasta and your egg, if you like greens.
Yeah.
How's that?
Molto bene.
Molto bene. Mille grazie.
That sounds
yummy. I can't
believe
I'm talking Italian on the radio.
Yeah. Thank you for your call, and good luck with that meal. 543-5869, 1-800-289-5869. This question about the egg, isn't that how you make pasta alla carbonara?
Yeah.
You put a raw egg
and
in.
Caesar salad and so on. I mean, there's plenty of places where you do use raw egg, like mayonnaise and stuff like
uh-huh.
that. You just have to be aware of the temperature. And I think that, you know, the story of salmonella is not something we find on a daily basis. This is, you know, we do have good protection and we do have good surveillance on that kind of behavior. I mean, you obviously could always get it because you live in the city and you're asking a chicken to bring the eggs all the way here.
Right.
Just like you're asking CSA, which is you want to be a farmer. You want to eat like a farmer, but you live in downtown Seattle.
Exactly. So bring me your box.
You are going to be stuck with eating what you don't want to eat.
Can you use, I have a friend who keeps ducks in the city, and so he'll bring duck eggs.
I love duck eggs. We use so much duck eggs.
So can I do something like this with a duck egg?
Yeah, I would do a sunny side up. That would be my favorite thing to do.
So fry.
A nice sunny side up and then put that on top of your pasta. I mean, that's one thing then Vic can do too. You know, he can make a sunny side up egg, a little bit of olive oil or butter. I like butter. Put butter in a pan, white foamy butter, put your duck egg or your chicken egg right in the center of it, and just let it cook slowly, very gently. And it will cook from the bottom up,
mm-hmm.
and the yolk will stay very tender.
Mm-hmm.
That's fine. I mean, there is no...
Well, those sunny-side-up eggs also go on that fried rice with leeks
oh, yeah.
that I was telling you about.
It goes on a lot. It goes in soups. It goes in many different things.
Well, I did try to bake with these duck eggs.
Oh, they're so great.
Well, but it was... I was making cookies, I believe, sugar cookies, and they like it became one giant cookie. So are there different, they're bigger, that's I guess. I don't know.
It became one giant cookie maybe because you put the dough together too close.
Oh, could be, but I've made these before and I have not had that problem. So
is it big? Maybe because they're so big and they're so,
maybe.
I mean, they're so big than you had now a lot more liquid into your dough, which made it a bit more runny.
Somebody told me they would be richer.
They are definitely richer.
So you like them.
Oh, I love them. For pastry, I mean, duck eggs are delicious in cakes.
Are you much of a baker yourself?
Not as much as I don't practice as much as I would like to, but I like baking, yes. It's a good...
Well,
you know, the outcome of baking is so delicious.
Yes, it is. I can't argue
with
you.
You know, we're all little gourmands out there.
Mary's in Seattle. Hi, Mary.
Hi, Mary.
Like a minute or so.
All righty. I have, hello, thank you very much for being what you're doing. I have scallops
And I have a variety of onions and peppers and asparagus and garlic and God knows everything, but I'm trying to figure out something cool to do with my scallops.
Well, how do you like your scallop normally?
Well, I really like them where they're tender inside and sort of crispy on the outside. So normally I have, you know, stuck them in a hot pan.
Okay, so the best way to do this is to have normally to buy scallop that are called dry scallop, which means they haven't been soaked into any product of salty water, sodium water, which normally a lot of the scallop practice is done that way because the scallop absorb the weight and scallops are sold by the pound. So they double up or triple up in size. And what you have, what you're buying is water. But most importantly, if you need to make sure that your scallop is very dry. Because if you don't have very dry scallop, you're not going to be able to seal them correctly on the outside. So you want to put them in paper towel, preferably as long as possible, and try to see if there is any rendering of liquid. If there is a lot of rendering of liquid, you might eventually be lucky to have rendered all the liquid before you cook them. So then take a very hot pan and wait till your pan is really, really hot. Then drop a little bit of olive oil or toss the scallop in a little bit of olive oil and then take that scallop and put it in a pan. But make sure the pan is really hot. Don't be afraid of heat. And then sear your scallop on both sides. You're going to see, and don't touch the scallop. Don't touch the scallop for at least 20 seconds until it's got that beautiful sear crispiness on the outside. Then flip it on the other side. And then once they're completely nice and seared, take them out of the pan. And then you can do, on the side of that, you can either choose to do a hot or cold salad. What I would do is turn on the barbecue and grill all those vegetables you have in the house, the peppers, the onion, all that, the garlic and everything, and then finish that with a wonderful salad. Put in the scallops, put the scallops in the oven for, or on the barbecue for a couple of minutes after they've been seared. They're going to be hot. Slice them, put them in the salad, and then you have a scallop and peppers and onion salad.
And Mary, with that, we've run out of time, so you leave us all salivating, Terry Rotaro. You know him as the chef in the hat. You have about a week or so left to catch Rovers while
That's
it's
right.
still open down in Madison Valley. You can always hop next door to Luke and
That's
have
right.
a nice meal there.
I'm not sure we have a reservation left at Rovers still, but you might want to try.
You can just stand outside and smell the air.
325-7442. I'll do it shamelessly.
Terry Rotaro, thanks for being with us.
And great pleasure, Marcy.
Coming up in the next hour, we're going to talk about news from Canada, surveillance by the Canadian government here on Weekday.
It's 9:59. You think you know all about distracted driving? You think voice-controlled apps are the safe way to go? Well, a new study has some interesting things to say about that. That's in the news in a minute. KUOW-FM Seattle, KUOW-Tumwater, KQOW-Bellingham, and Digital HD Services.
Support for KUOW comes from the Evening MBA and ISM program at Seattle Pacific University, hosting an open house on Thursday, June 13th from 4:30 until 6 p.m. More information and registration is available at spu.edu/business. Seattle Pacific University, engaging the culture, changing the world.
On the next Radiolab, a harrowing encounter with a humpback whale.
I was 18 inches away from her eye, and she just looked at me and let me touch her.
It really was a very emotional feeling. I felt this whale,
this 50-ton mammal, was literally...